Today, has the bad, mad misinformation bill hit the buffers? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the latest posts covering finance and property news. I've had a number of people ask for an update relating to the misinformation and disinformation bill, which is currently sitting in the Parliament. So today I'm going to give you the latest and also share some of the discussions that surfaced through the Senate inquiry hearings last Monday, which were very penetrating and very concerning. The bottom line is this: it's unlikely that this bill will pass the Senate because we've already had a number of independent senators come out against it, and we know that the opposition parties are also against it. And in fact, earlier in the week, Matt Canavan released this rather informative short post, which was at least encouraging.
I know many of you are concerned about our government's attempts to silence their own people through their absurd misinformation laws. You're right to be concerned because, as Donald Trump has said, if we don't have free speech, we don't have a free country. Now, I've been fighting against this attempt to silence Australians, and this week we've just wrapped up 3 days of public hearings in the Senate about these misinformation laws. And almost everybody that appeared at those hearings, civil liberty groups, lawyers, general community interest groups, almost all of them opposed this attempt to censor and gag the Australian people. Then we got some good news after these hearings. Yesterday, two senators came to the same conclusion you have. David Pocock and Tammy Tyrrell both said that they oppose these laws. This is not right to be telling people what to say. And they don't necessarily support me on everything. I support people who don't have the same opinion as me. They should have the right of free speech in this country. But we've still got a lot of work to do. On the basic math, right now, we're just one vote away from defeating these laws. If we get one more senator to say no, almost certainly these laws will not be able to pass in the last two sitting weeks before Christmas. So I need you to contact the local senators in your state, contact your local representatives, and tell them that you don't support the gagging of the Australian people. You do not support laws that would seek to protect the interests of governments over and above the rights of their citizens to criticise their own governments. We're so close to having a major victory for free speech here. A lot of that is because of the submissions and the posts on social media you have all done. But I need you now in these last couple of weeks before Christmas to give Australia a Christmas present and defeat these terrible laws. Contact your local senator and let's stand up for the basic rights of all Australians to have a free country where we can speak freely among each other.
Since then, more independent senators have come out against it, including Jackie Lanley. So it looks like the misinformation and disinformation bill will be added to this pile of stuff sitting in the Senate in the too hard basket. We aren't going to pass it.
Freedom of speech is a pillar of our democracy, and this bill threatens that. I've heard from so many of you who share this concern, and I agree. Of course, misinformation and disinformation are a problem, but this bill isn't the answer. The powers it grants could lead to over-censorship, with the government deciding what does and doesn't count as the truth. That's not the Australia I believe in. That's why I will vote against this bill. I will always stand up for our freedoms and for an Australia where all voices can be heard. You can rely on me to have your back.
I guess that perhaps will give the Labour Party additional incentives to look for a double dissolution. We will see. Prior to that, the bill did go through the lower house. And interestingly, because of course the weight of Labour is stronger there, it passed. Although I do know that Peter Dutton sat on the sidelines and abstained, which I thought was interesting. And of course, he has earlier on spoken about their alternative bill that would come if he was returned to power. So I'm not quite sure what's going on there, but it is concerning. Anyway, the action now is in the Senate with the Senate hearings. And of course, that inquiry is due to report back very soon. And on Monday, we heard from a number of experts, pretty much to a full person, asking significant questions about the bill. Actually, there are a couple of different angles of attack. The first was the overall question of whether this could be effective in any way whatsoever, especially as there's a massive disconnect between what's said in the bill and what's said in the supporting memorandum, the memorandum being the description of the bill. And Toomey, professor, of course, of constitutional law, really burrowed into this, and it's worth listening to some of the points that she made.
I think there is a distinction, particularly in relation to the inauthentic behaviour, because I think that's more easily identifiable and it's less contestable. Where I have concerns about the definition of disinformation is how one deals with the other category, where you say that the person intends to deceive. I've looked at the material where they talk about you just now need some reasonable sort of suspicion that the person intends to deceive, and that could be because they have previously been told that their statements or their dissemination has been fact-checked and it's been said to be false, and therefore if they publish it again, it makes disinformation. I have some concerns about that because certainly in some cases, if it really is verifiably false, then yes, fair enough, maybe they are trying to deceive. But I would imagine in many circumstances, the person is not intending to deceive. In fact, that they disagree with what the fact checkers have said and want to put their disagreement out in the public realm. And deciding that is disinformation simply on the basis that some fact checker has decided on the basis of one or two experts that something is false, it's not necessarily false. Just because you've checked with some experts, or even if there's an expert consensus that something is false, doesn't actually mean it really is. People can still believe genuinely what they are saying is true, and I don't think one should necessarily assume that they are deliberately trying to deceive people, even if they keep disseminating material that other people say is false.
Okay. And I'll open this
around the whether or not the bill, in your view, potentially restricts the constitutional protection for political freedom of political discussion. I know the explanatory memoranda has some attempt there to say it doesn't. I wonder whether it seriously does meet a test of proportionality. It seems to me a bit of a tick and flick around this issue. I think it raises serious issues about political communication. Just wondered your view on how do you think, I know it's hard to speculate, but how do you think a high court might view some of the actions taken potentially under this bill?
Okay, I'm guessing that's to me. First of all, there are bits in the bill where they attempt to put in a proportionality test to address that. They pop up in a few places, but curiously, they don't use the same wording that the High Court does. So it's a more minimal test. So, for example, if ACMA can't approve a code unless it's satisfied that, you know, it's reasonably necessary, etc. So they don't use the exact words, so that's going to be a problem in itself. But look, I think that there are potentially, and it depends, it seems to be a difference between what's actually said in the bill and then what the EM says it's supposed to say, all right? And this is where I find this all very confusing. So the bill, for example, says that it's misleading if it's reasonably verifiable as false or misleading, okay? And a normal human being would think, okay, then is that something that you can actually prove is a matter that's true or false? So, for example, an advertisement that uses a celebrity's face and says that, you know, or Twiggy Forrest or someone, and says that, you know, I'm supporting this and here's my business thing. And it's a scam. It's false, okay? Things like that, you can just prove that are false. Fine. But then you look at what it says in the EM and it says, no, we're not just dealing with facts here. We're dealing with opinions and commentary and claims and invective. And you think, well, you can't prove those things are false. You can't prove that someone's opinion is false. It's an opinion. And so then it goes on in the EM and it says, oh, how do you do that? Oh, you get a fact checker to decide. I deal with fact checkers all the time. In fact, during some periods, I felt like I've been working for free for them for an awfully long time. And look, and that's a problem in itself. I mean, getting experts, okay? There are very few people who are prepared to waste their time doing this stuff because they have a real job, okay? So very few people who actually do it. You can be quite selective about the experts that you choose. On any political issue, you can find experts on both sides. So say, for example, coalition argument for the next election, nuclear energy is economically efficient and better than renewables, all right? Assume that's what you're stating. Could you find three economists who'd say, no, nuclear energy is not more efficient than renewables? Pretty easy, I would imagine. Okay, so you can find that and you put it out there. You've now put out a fact check out there saying that that's false or misleading on the basis of what's said. Well, then you'd say, okay, well, does that cause harm? All right. And then you look at the serious harm and then it says, well, harm to the operation or integrity of a Commonwealth electoral process. And you'd think on the face of the words, well, this isn't harming the process at all. But then you look at the explanatory memorandum. An explanatory memorandum gives these examples of Germany where disinforming news sort of drove people into the arms of a right-wing populist party. And it goes on to say that the study concluded disinformation beliefs were apparently one of the reasons for the electoral success of right-wing populists. And it goes on and says that misinformation of this kind can cause people to not be giving genuine votes and that undermines the electoral process. All right. So if that's true, if what's said in the explanatory memorandum is actually right, then this is getting into the actual political issues that lead to the voting. So on the face of the words, you'd say, well, no, it's not, because it's only about undermining the electoral process itself. So, you know, people who make silly arguments about voting machines being rigged. We don't use a voting machine. We use a pencil. Okay, that's verifiably untrue. But once you get beyond what's verifiably untrue to things like claims and opinions that are made during an election process, and once you say, oh, it's not just the electoral process, but we say the electoral process is undermined if people are told things that might mislead them, then you're right slap bang into political communication. And that's where the thing will fall over. Now, the problem for me is that when I read the bill, I thought, oh, it's okay, because it's referring to things that are verifiably false and it's only dealing with if you're mucking up the electoral processes, not the political content. But when I read the explanatory memorandum, I'm seeing something completely different. All right? And that confusion for me is where potentially the constitutional problem comes in.
It's also interesting that the Victorian Law Council highlighted the fact that their submission seems to have been warped in the updates to the bill and its meaning actually turned on its head.
Because this most peculiar insertion in the explanatory memorandum, which is an extraordinary document, that opinions, claims, commentary and invective can constitute misinformation is one of the most disturbing aspects of this bill for the Victorian Bar, and here's why. When the original exposure draft came out, the Victorian Bar made a submission to the Law Council of Australia, which used those words, opinions, claims, commentary and invective, as online content that did not seem to us possibly to amount to information and therefore would not be encompassed within a definition of misinformation in the then exposure draft. And that the task of online platforms and the ACMA would be to distinguish information from things that were opinions, claims, etc. And that there will therefore be a temptation on both platforms and regulators to classify disfavoured opinions as being factual claims about misinformation and therefore within the regulatory net. And you can see that replicated in the Law Council's submission to this Senate inquiry. It's submission number 75 on page 16, replicating the language of the Victorian Bar's submission to the Law Council, which in turn made a submission on the exposure draft. What astonished us was then when the explanatory memorandum came out to see that our point, namely that there was a grave danger to freedom of expression, had been flipped on its head explicitly in the explanatory memorandum to encompass the very thing that we feared, namely that views, opinions, claims, invective, all of the kind of things that one sees on the internet that are not factual claims which are capable of verification, are, according to the government's explanatory memorandum, encompassed in this bill. And as Professor Toomey says, that's getting towards the heartland of the constitutional freedom. As the Victorian Bar submission makes clear, yes, we have a capital C constitutional concern about the bill, but we also have a much broader concern about freedom of expression, whether expressed in human rights terms or not. And that inclusion of opinion and claims within the definition of misinformation, not according to the text of the bill, mind you, but according to the explanatory memorandum, what gives us grave concern. That's where the language came from. It was our concern about the overreach of the bill has taken on a new life in a very disturbing way, in our view.
I will say that there were people who gave evidence who really underscored the difficulty of this bill and why it should not pass. It's government overreach, it's censorship, it's ultimately a ministry of truth.
Go directly to Senator Roberts.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you to Citizen Go for attending and also for your submission. President Trump, who's just been swept to power, promises to dismantle the censorship regime globally. The Vice President-elect, J.D. Vance, has in the last few days indicated that the United States would penalise nations for adopting the exact measures contained in this bill. What effect will this have on the operability of this bill? Is this bill likely to undermine AUKUS?
Yes, it is, and the outcome of what President-elect Trump has said effectively makes this bill null and void and dead in the water. So you are trying to enact legislation, I say the metaphorical you, are trying to enact legislation that... are trying to enact legislation that would be effectively dead in the water. If I ran one of the major social media giants, Facebook, Google or even X, I would just merely shut down my Australian operations, operate out of America where I have free speech amendment protections and completely ignore whatever your legislation says. I know you're not going to shut me down, so I will just continue to operate.
Thank you. Do you think they really will shut down operations in Australia? Because the government says that they cannot trust social media platforms. I agree. The platforms are the problem. Isn't it that we need more transparency of these platforms and what they do and how they censor already, indiscriminately and for their own purposes?
The platforms are a problem. I don't trust them either. That being said, I definitely don't trust the government when it comes to trying to protect people from misinformation. The greatest peddlers of misinformation historically has been government MPs and the administrative state. So, an example, weapons of mass destruction, the Russiagate hoax, Hunter Biden laptop story. Safe and effective. Gladys Berejiklian effectively telling people if they sat down they won't catch COVID, but if they stand up they will. This legislation is the equivalent of saying, well, we have an issue with bushfires, so let's hand over power to arsonists. It is insane. It should not be enacted in any way, shape or form. So while social media companies have their issues, whilst I do not trust social media companies, what you're finding is there is already an open source solution to misinformation. X is a perfect example. Community Nights, I would say, is far more accurate than what ACMA would ever be able to achieve.
So what we're hearing from the government is we cannot trust social media platforms, yet the government now gives them added power, added incentive to actually censor people even more.
Well,
is that not correct?
They effectively make social media platforms another tier of government by working closely with them to shut down any online dissent or anything that could be deemed misinformation, using very spurious definitions of what would be considered misinformation or harmful content.
Thank you. As I understand the bill, the penalties for under-censoring are severe on social media platforms. The penalties for over-censoring are non-existent. Isn't that an automatic incentive to over-censor?
Yes.
Protect social media responsibilities?
Well, we've already seen cases where, albeit in other countries, social media companies have over-censored information, and that's in the absence of misinformation legislation. Hunter Biden laptop story is the perfect example. That was a completely true story. All of it was factually correct. the CEO of Facebook has admitted that he was approached by intelligence community assets and told to get rid of the information. They shut that down at a time during an election where it actually could have informed voters. And that's in a country where they have a free speech amendment and they don't have misinformation legislation. Imagine what would happen in this country if someone went out there and actually had information that could sway an election and it was truthful, but we have an unelected bureaucracy with deeply flawed people. We're all flawed, we're all biased, acting on legislation that has a very vague definition of what constitutes misinformation and what constitutes serious harm. Imagine what they would do in a country like Australia. They would crack down on all forms of information. It's an egregious bill.
So your proposal is perfectly clear. I'm going to quote. The bill represents an unprecedented threat to free speech in Australia.
Yes.
It goes on to say the right to free speech is a God-given liberty essential to human dignity and democracy. End of quote. Would you characterise this bill as a direct attack on Australia's democracy?
Absolutely.
And is one of the problems not the fact that there is no arbiter to truth, and yet in the real world, the best way to expose the truth is to have free and open debate until the truth is revealed?
Yeah, when it comes to speech, the best disinfectant is sunlight, right? So if there's bad speech out there, if there's incorrect speech out there, the best thing is to have more speech to counter that. We see that, you know, in its early stages with Community Notes on X, where you've got an open source system where people can fact check misleading claims. And as I said, often these misleading claims come from the people that are proposing to regulate misleading claims.
22,000 of your members clearly agree with you. Are your members planning to campaign personally against any member of this parliament that supported this bill?
Absolutely.
How many members do you expect to have on the ground by next May?
We have over 100,000 members in our database in Australia alone. I would expect thousands to be on the ground.
You invoke the late Liberal Party founder Sir Robert Menzies' quote, "The whole essence of freedom is that it is freedom for others as well as for ourselves. Freedom for people who disagree with us as well as for our supporters. Freedom for minorities as well as for majorities." End of quote. Opposition leader Peter Dutton did not vote against the bill in the House of Reps. Do you believe, and I believe that the Liberal Party, and I believe that Peter Dutton wants his own misinformation, disinformation bill. Do you believe Peter Dutton's reported support for this bill in some form is abandoning core Liberal Party value?
So I might just stop you there, Senator sure. Roberts. At the vote last week, I believe you'll find that that Mr. Dutton did indeed vote against the bill.
That's okay, correct, well, no, yeah. I stand corrected.
Coalition voted against the bill in the yeah. House.
Just so that you're putting an accurate question to the witness here.
Thank you.
I know
you
it only
much.
Happened very, very recently. Yep.
And it's illustrative what we need. You've just corrected me, and I've accepted that correction.
We won't
however, it's also
though.
Correct.
We didn't have to go to ACMA.
Such misinformation, Malcolm.
Exactly. It's also correct. It's also correct that the Morrison Little Proud government, introduced the misinformation disinformation bill, and that Peter Dutton has said that he supports a Liberal bill and will go towards introducing that. Is the Liberal Party abandoning core Liberal Party values?
Look, the Liberal Party needs to just look at their We Believe statement and enact any legislation that abides by that. That's been my position for a long time. Sometimes the Liberal Party sleepwalks into stupid legislation to try and appease people who hate them, and it doesn't work. So my hope is that they do not enact speech controls, which is what these sorts of bills are. My hope is that they oppose the misinformation bill in its entirety, in any form.
We have heard from the Victorian Bar that they consider this bill as a guaranteed litigation risk. I note your submission talks about Citizen Go testing the bill in court. Do you think this bill has the capacity to turn into a legal nightmare the government wished they never caused? Will this bill be a nightmare for social media platforms, the government, the courts and social media users, and a harvest for lawyers?
Yes, it will, and we intend to challenge it if passed.
Staff has just checked the Hansard to, and it shows that Peter Dutton abstained from the vote against the misinformation or vote on the misinformation disinformation bill. The pairs were nil, so apparently he wasn't paired. He was not recorded, so he didn't support or oppose the bill.
Okay, we might get a point of clarification from the Liberal Party. I don't wish for Mr. Dutton to be misrepresented here.
Neither do I. I'm just quoting the Hansard.
Yeah. No. But I think a point. I'll leave that to my colleagues from the coalition to get us a point of clarity on that.
And I also note that some of the religious groups, both the Jewish community and the Muslim community, are also against the bill for very good reasons.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us today. I've got your opening statement, I believe, or that your submission, rather. You mentioned in there that there's strong community opposition to these proposed changes and you've been inundated with messages of concern. Would you mind just elaborating on, I guess, the level of community concern you've detected amongst your membership?
Well, Senator, the AJA is guided by genuine Jewish values, by Torah values, and our tradition going back thousands of years for Jewish academic development is built on free speech. It's built on a contest of ideas. Even back to biblical times, when emerged two major Jewish learning institutes called Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, they were known for having contrary views on the interpretation of Judaism and Jewish practice. If you like, they had their different views of what the truth is. And we've had a number of messages from rabbis, from people in the Orthodox community, that the whole basis upon which Jewish academia stands is that a person should be free to express their views, express their assessments on various issues, not so much obviously as to advocate violence, but the contest of ideas is a major part of our tradition. Jewish practice involves learning. It's a major part. It's why Jews are sometimes referred to as the people of the book, and that should be conducted in Australia. And in some ways, what is being proposed now before the Parliament is a less mature approach to the contest of ideas than has existed in Jewish tradition even a couple of thousand years ago. So that's sort of the basis of the concern. It's come mainly from the rabbis, mainly from those in the Orthodox community, but also those that are centre-right conservative politically and see it as an important foundation of Western democracy broadly.
Mm. And I'll just add to that, many members of the Jewish community, they come from places like the former Soviet Union, like apartheid South Africa, so they do understand the implications of the government policing whether certain speech is acceptable or not. And going into specific examples, I know we've dealt with earlier today the religious teachings, things around gender and marriage. There's concern in the community that Jewish practices, which are thousands of years old, could come under in breach of the law. But the bigger issue is, even if individuals aren't going to be prosecuted, if it's going to be the social media companies that are, it has a chilling effect on free speech. And that's something, that's a concern we're hearing from the Jewish community, that people are going to self-censor. AJA has been ourselves targeted by various online campaigns. You know, we've had strikes against our accounts. We've even had a social media account taken down. And we always manage to overcome these obstacles because they're unfounded, but the average person is not going to fight against the big social media companies, and they may just give in, they may self-censor, and this is going to create a really chilling impact on political speech and all speech in this country.
Hmm. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Ms. Markwell, for appearing. It's very much appreciated. This is a very important bill. Can I just ask, in view of the threats that were made against other witnesses, were you threatened for appearing?
No, I was not threatened.
Thank you. Now, the government says that we cannot trust social media platforms, and I agree with that. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Thank you. So the platforms are the problem. We need more transparency, not less. And yet, even though the government doesn't
doesn't trust these social media platforms, it's asking them to do the censoring. Would you agree?
With this bill, or you mean in general?
No, with the government's with the government in this bill, it is getting the social media giants to do the censoring, foreign-controlled social media giants to do the censoring for it.
There is a system in place to hold them to account if they don't sort of meet certain standards. But yes, essentially, the social media companies are still doing it.
Right. I can't find anywhere in this bill where there is an arbiter of truth. Can you?
I can't see that.
No. Doesn't that create enormous problems because it leaves open for the social media platforms, or if they're not doing it to the government's satisfaction, it leaves open to ACMA to be the arbiter of truth?
Well, I think the point of the bill is to demand higher standards of moderation from social media companies in relation to misinformation and disinformation, but it does link it to specific categories of harm. Our concern is that the categories of harm that are currently in the bill go too broad and that they should, especially the last three, I think, in the list we have concerns about, but the others we think are important public harms that should be moderated against. And while there is no, complaints mechanism or ability for ACMA to really act as an arbiter of truth per se, there is scope for evidence about harm that is coming about from misinformation and disinformation to be surfaced and then for ACMA to act upon it. We do think, though, that ACMA needs to be separated from government in making these calls. Political officers should not be able to influence ACMA in relation to suppressing any content. And ACMA should also have very clear guidelines about what is, for example, when it comes to the harm of hatred, what constitutes dehumanising material, so they are really clear on that. And there is also support from the research sector, which I think this bill currently neglects and puts a lot of responsibility on the shoulders of ACMA without empowering the research sector to be analysing what is exactly happening on social media platforms.
The other point to make here is that there is a significant disconnect as well, because clearly we don't like the way that social media companies currently moderate content. It's done in a non-transparent way. And through the hearings, we heard examples of different posts that were taken down and subsequently perhaps were proved to be more right than wrong, for example, around COVID and other things. So there is absolutely a need for greater transparency and greater disclosure from the social media companies as to when and how they're intervening with shadow banning or indeed removing content. But that is separate and a very critical issue, but a separate issue from the question of who should moderate and control content.
But I think what is also often ignored is that the platforms are already making these assessments. The platforms are already shadow banning, is what some folks call it. They're already taking action on content as well as on accounts, whether to prioritise content, to monetise or demonetise content. So these actions are already being taken by the platforms. And I think that it is important, while we're also just talking about balancing the rights to free speech, that we also take into account that these decisions are already being taken right now. And there is no way of knowing how those decisions are being made, who's making them. Often these decisions are made by technology, so that raises other concerns. And what we believe is that the bill does need improvement. It is workable from a human rights perspective because it actually does go to giving some oversight over what the platforms are already making, all the decisions the platforms are already making on content. And in fact, the platforms are the ones who are making the bulk of these decisions, either by technology or by having fact checkers or a combination of the two. So I do think that that perspective is really important to also highlight. And do agree, of course, with Professor Toomey that at some point, ACMA is going to have to make a determination. But also noting that, of course, the platforms are already making thousands of those determinations right now.
Okay. The Victorian Bar shares those concerns. What strikes us is that, by definition, misinformation and disinformation won't be revealed simply by looking at the content of the post itself. It will always depend on a contrast being made between what is stated or depicted in the post and some extrinsic understanding of what the truth is. Because unless it's shown by reference to something else to be false or to be misleading, you haven't shown it to be, under however imperfectly, the definitions to be misinformation or disinformation. That relies on some person or some process making such a determination, and by definition under this bill, ACMA is the ultimate decider of that. There's another level which concerns us, which is not merely whether ACMA is rightly or otherwise described as being a ministry of truth by determining what is or is not true. There's also the problem that either ACMA or possibly worse, platform operators decide what the official party line is, whether or not it's true. Mm. And that's the force of Professor Toomey's point, that simply because a fact checker has determined, perhaps for their own reasons, that a certain statement is or is not true, does not mean that as an objective matter it is. That's our concern.
Now, over the 8 hours in the afternoon, we had a number of government departments who were sort of lukewarm to positive towards the bill. The emergency services people said there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation about national emergencies, and helping that would be quite good.
I do think that the important thing is for us to maintain a capability where we can actively engage. I just reinforce that point. So it's no longer a point of, you know, an authoritative voice being or message being put out and that's it. You actually have to engage in the conversation that is ongoing. So that puts significant pressure, in particular at the height of national emergencies is an important part. The flip side of that, though, I would still argue that us being part of that is just part of how we've evolved in the information age as well. So, you know, putting authoritative information out, you know, dispelling any myths and making sure that the public have as much information that they have so that they can actually make decisions, but it's that authoritative source that is the critical part. But then just to wrap up, just reinforcing my point, you know, I'm a very strong believer in transparency, openness, etc. But I do believe that, you know, we need levers, in particular when you're looking at disinformation.
Senator Cadell.
Just not wanting to put back. NEMA isn't always right, though, in all these things. You get some stuff wrong yourself, don't you?
Well, I don't know so much about getting stuff wrong. What I would say is that we use the best information that we have at a point in time. And as things evolve, and I always talk about at the really early stages of a crisis or a disaster, there's always a degree of, you know, the fog of a crisis. And so we work really hard at having the most accurate, the best information at that time, and then, but we will correct, you know, as we go.
That was very similar to Dr. Coatsworth, who was here on first day of hearings, second day, mm-hmm. first day of hearings. You give the best information you can at the time you have it, but that evolves, doesn't it?
Yeah, so absolutely.
That's why the timeliness of information you have. We talk of the context and the timing of stuff. My learned friend here was talking about the Earth being the centre of the universe earlier today. At times, that was correct. So we have to watch how the context of information flows for the honesty. I've been in a bushfire in my valley. My valley was, I saw information coming through 15 minutes before that the fire had turned and but it hadn't been updated that. So I don't say you go out there and create misinformation you don't create disinformation because everything you put is correct at the time you put it, but time can turn information into misinformation, can't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a point in time, and you know, like as you said, what you're experiencing on the ground, could be slightly different around the system that's actually delivering that information.
It was just a wind change that hadn't been picked up.
And a wind change and local conditions as well. I mean, I come from an operational background, and I've actually been on the ground, and then I've actually been getting even information from, like, you know, different levels of within the system. So that's the key thing. You actually, like, any good system uses multiple points of information. And, you know, and so that's why I think there's a degree around when you talk about misinformation.
Yeah.
An individual standing on the ground will experience, I'll use fire as an example, being that you've experienced that, Senator, you will see what you are experiencing in front of you, and that might be different to what the broad sort of messaging is. And that's why the importance of, you know, the different layers of information that's being pushed in. And that's why, for me, the really focus point is around for more disinformation than the misinformation, because there is a degree of self-regulation within the misinformation environment.
Thank you, Jeff.
Others were more full bore in support, although you have to question why. And ACMA, who is the critical agency, were highly unimpressive and frankly went round in circles.
Focused on platforms themselves, digital platforms, and the commitments that they make under the codes that they submit to ACMA, not about the people that post information to those platforms. It's focused on the platforms. And then, of course, if it's not the codes, it's standards that ACMA might have required if the code process was inadequate. There are circumstances in the bill where individuals with knowledge of the code's compliance with, sorry, of knowledge of the platform's compliance with the code, such as employees of the platforms, might be asked to provide information to assist ACMA. But there is no circumstances in this bill at all where individuals would be the subject of such proceedings. I'm not quite sure where that information's coming from. It's absolutely incorrect.
Thank you. Well, that's good to clarify and get on record. There's also been a lot of talk about censorship. I'm sure you've been kind of following this as it's been going. So, you know, what is the situation around this bill basically censoring people? What do you say about that?
So, again, there's no censorship in relation to this bill. The bill is about codes that digital platforms themselves undertake, and the codes at the moment, for example, the Digi code, which is a voluntary code, purports to deal with mis and disinformation. As you'd be aware, there was a process whereby one of the members of that code, X, was removed from the code arrangements because of its failure to comply with the commitments that the industry itself had made as part of the Digi code, based on the commitments the platforms themselves had made about mis and disinformation. And so the bill builds on that by bringing into the process mandatory obligations for the platforms to comply with those codes, to deal with exactly this situation whereby some participants might choose just not to comply with the code. And again, this would be a code that the industry itself had submitted to ACMA to deal with the very narrowly defined mis and disinformation content. And really importantly, as I think Mr. Chapman referred to earlier, there's no circumstances here where ACMA is asking the platforms to take information out of the code, unless we're dealing with disinformation, inauthentic behaviour, bots, that sort of example. So it's not true that it has those curtailments. It's building on the existing regime, the existing system.
Yeah, thanks. I think that clears that up for me. Just in terms of definitions of harm, there's been a claim around imminent harm to the Australian economy is too broad and that it could capture things, for example, a debate around interest rates. That's come up a couple of times. Can you just talk through the definition of imminent harm to the Australian economy and whether a debate about interest rates would be picked up in your view?
I can't see a situation where a debate about interest rates would itself constitute mis and disinformation as defined under this bill. Again, it would need to be both verifiably false and misleading and have significant and far-reaching consequences and pose that risk of harm. So a debate with different opinions doesn't fall into that category. And again, there's many, many steps you have to get through before ACMA even engages its own regulatory function in relation to information that someone might say is mis and disinformation. You'd need to have a code in place where the industry itself has said how it is going to deal with mis and disinformation in relation to issues like imminent harm to the economy. You would then need that code to be registered by ACMA and then go through all those processes that we talked about before. But a debate about interest rates doesn't fit into that category.
So I guess kind of similarly, this question about others claiming that the bill has a low threshold of harm in general, but I think you've just talked through that the bill doesn't cover all dissemination of content, so it's got to fit into those categories you've just described. Is there anything else that you would add, I guess, outside of a debate about interest rates in terms of the commentary about the bill having a low threshold?
Not really, because it's a pretty high threshold. So here we're talking about, you know, information, and the explanatory memoranda talks about some examples of economic harm. So, Mr. Hiles, would you like to refer to any of that?
Look, I'd really just reiterate the point that Mr. Chisholm's made about, you know, the bill is very clear that serious harm, you know, in that context has to have significant and far-reaching consequences for the Australian community or a segment of the Australian community, or severe consequences for an individual in Australia. So, you know, people idly speculating about interest rates, you know, isn't going to trigger that sort of thing. That the threshold is much higher than that.
Thank you.
Rotate, Senator Dunman, sorry. I know everyone's coming up short. Senator Roberts.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you all for appearing today. My questions initially go to the department. Under the Communications Legislation Amendment Combating Misinformation and Disinformation Bill 2024, ACMA is responsible for taking action against a media company that has not followed the Misinformation and Disinformation Code. This would include allowing misinformation and disinformation to appear on that media company's own platform. Is that correct so far?
Senator, if I could just clarify a question, is your question that ACMA would allow mis and disinformation on their platforms?
ACMA would allow it in the sense that they do not take down what appears as misinformation on a media company's platform. Is that correct so far?
ACMA would require code signatories to comply with the mis and disinformation obligations they have signed up to under those codes. But that does not include takedown powers. But they still must comply with their code, which deals with mis and disinformation as defined under the bill.
Who decides if something is misinformation or not on the media company's platform? Because the media company publishes it on the presumably either intentionally to misinform and disinform or unconsciously, unknowingly. So who decides if something is misinformation or disinformation on the media company's own platform?
Yeah, so there's a definition of the of excluded dissemination under the bill, but also, Senator, ultimately, at first instance, it's the platforms themselves, because they are creating the codes that are registered by ACMA.
I understand that, Mr. Chisholm, yeah. But where a platform honestly believes that it is not peddling misinformation, it's accurate information, but it is disinformation, who polices them?
Well, I'll just ask Mr. Hiles to answer that question, Senator.
So, Senator, I think you referenced, you know, news content. So I think it's just important...
No, I didn't reference anything, just content.
You were talking about disinformation, though, Senator, just to check, rather than mis and dis? It was disinformation?
Misinformation and disinformation both. On yep. The media company's own platform. Yep. Put there in good faith, probably, but nonetheless, misinformation or disinformation.
If Senator... Sorry, Ms. Chapman was about to answer.
Senator, the first point is that if it has been content that has been created by the media company, and that is a media company that fits within the exemption that Mr. Howells was referring to, for example, if we were talking about a member of the Press Council or a...
No, I'm talking about, say, Facebook, Twitter or X. If they are in charge of enforcing the misinformation and disinformation code, yes, but unwittingly they put misinformation or disinformation on their own page, their own, their own page.
Oh, so Senator,
who would correct them?
So that's right, Senator. That would then come down to a question of, by keeping that information on the platform, are they or are they not complying with the code? And the code itself deals with mis and disinformation. Then that would be a question.
So who would
that
would, pick
would be
that
then
up?
A question for ACMA to determine with
ACMA. Thank with you. The, that's what I was asking.
With the platform, and I'm just looking at the regulator to make sure I've got that right.
Yeah, but Senator, we would not be taking a complaint, for example, about a particular piece of information that has been put on the platform. Let's just say, for example, by Facebook. If there is a code in place in this situation, if there is a code that is registered, we would be looking to see whether that code has been complied with. Now, that code may, for example, it's a very hypothetical situation to try and envisage what may or may not be in a code in the future, but there are some...
What I'm getting at is...
Well, it'll be a matter for
Facebook
it'll be a matter for the platform.
Might not comply with its own code.
It will be a matter for the platform to comply with the codes and to deal with mis and disinformation in accordance with that code.
But yes, Senator.
And what about if it unwittingly did not comply with its own code because it honestly thought it wasn't misinformation?
That usually, Senator, is a question resolved between the regulator and the entity about...
So ACMA. Okay, thank you.
But equally, Senator, if it becomes apparent that a platform, for example, has inadvertently done something that is not in compliance with its code. Let's say, for example, there are requirements inside the code which require them to take complaints from members of the public, and then if the platform itself decides that it is misinformation, it didn't realise earlier it was, but it now has made an assessment of that code themselves and realised it's misinformation, the code may, for example, say that they are then required to deal with it in a certain manner. It might be that they
so if it did comply it or... if it didn't comply with the code, who would take it down, or who would be responsible for getting them to take it down?
There's no takedown.
There are no takedown provisions.
It's about whether they've complied with the code, and there are penalties for not complying with the code, but it doesn't require takedown.
And the code will only deal with systems and processes. It will not deal with particular. The role of the ACMA in dealing with that code will be in relation to its systems and processes, not content.
But ACMA will be the regulatory agency enforcing that.
The code. Yep. If there is a code registered. Yep. Yes.
Thank you.
I could share the whole of that evidence set, but I won't. But I do encourage you to go and check out the full show, which is on YouTube, because the parliamentary system now posts hearings on YouTube directly, so the links are below. Anyway, where we are, I think, is that the bill is unlikely to pass. We have enough resistance in the Senate now to make sure that the bill is parked, at least for a period of time. But I do think it is still worth contacting senators and making sure that they understand just how much we, the ordinary people, resist this bill, because whilst the idea of more transparency in terms of the way social media platforms moderate is a good thing, the idea of trying to define truth and only allowing the government, universities, and the mainstream media to be the arbiters of truth seems to me to be problematic. And of course, the truth is, and as people said during the hearings, it's often the government that actually disseminates the most misinformation and disinformation. And of course, they are allowed to continue to do that, whereas other people would have significantly more difficulty. And that means that the quality and range of content and debate would be diminished. The bottom line is it's unlikely that it'll pass. But I also think that we do have to recognise that there is some troubling content up on social media platforms, and it's important that the social media platforms are put under the gun to deal with really bad stuff. But really bad stuff is not the same as different views and different opinions. So we need a whole different approach, I think, to misinformation and disinformation. And the bill in its current form is overreach. And frankly, I have no idea why Labour has spent so much capital on it, other than, of course, they are very much in lockstep with Europe and the US and elsewhere. And it seems to me that this is probably a reflection of a top-down directive from the non-elected entities that actually set the agenda internationally. So that's the state of play, and I'll keep you updated as things develop. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.